the root causes of violence, especially in Aboriginal people's communities and in society at large, stems from colonialism.
By law, they cannot come and physically remove us or remove our structures.
We're putting together an online handbook that will teach people both how to set up a cooperative and how to set up a community radio station, and ultimately how to set up a co-op community radio station.
For the good of all, it was decided that all the structures would be removed.
Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news.
This episode of Groundwire is produced on Sinek's traditional territory in the studios of CJLY, a cooperative community station in Nelson, BC. In this episode of Groundwire, we'll hear a report on the United Nations inquiry into the ongoing problem of unsolved cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada. We'll hear a wrap-up from Occupy Nelson, BC, surely one of the smallest cities to host an Occupy force. We'll also hear an excerpt from the documentary Modern Slavery in Canada and the World. On the Community Radio Report, we'll hear about Community Radio on Cortez Island in BC. We'll also hear details about a collaboration in support of cooperatives between the National Campus and Community Radio Association and Kootenai Cooperative Radio in Nelson. There are no headlines this week, so we'll start off with a bit of music. This is an excerpt from Where We Belong by Toronto's Lal from the album Deportation. United Nations has recently announced it will conduct an inquiry into the ongoing problem of unsolved cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada. CKUT Radio's Aaron Lakoff has the story from Montreal.
According to the Native Women's Association of Canada, or NWAC, there are over 600 unsolved cases of missing or murdered Indigenous women across the country since the 1980s. This has been a pressing issue for Indigenous communities in Canada, as the families of these women continue to demand accountability from police forces and different levels of government. However, some solace came for Aboriginal communities on December 13th, when NWAC announced in a joint press release with the Feminist Alliance for International Action that a 23-person team from the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW, would be coming to Canada to lead an inquiry into missing and murdered Native women in February 2012. This is Jeanette Corbière-Lavelle, the president of NWAC.
So our call for a national inquiry on missing and murdered Aboriginal women hasn't been acknowledged by the federal government, by Canada specifically. So about a year and a half ago, along with the Feminist Alliance International Organization, we approached the committee, you know, for the elimination of discrimination against women and said, you know, this is taking place here in Canada, and something must be done because it can't continue.
According to the Native newspaper Windspeaker, last summer NWAC called for the federal government to conduct a national inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women, but got no reply. Instead, in 2010, the Stephen Harper government cut all funding to Sisters in Spirit, a program of NWAC which conducted research and funded action to solve the problem. In its place, the Harper government devoted $10 million towards a new program called Evidence to Action. Bridget Tolley is just one family member of the over 600 missing and murdered women who are not satisfied with the government's new approach. Her own mother, Gladys Tolley, was killed on October 5, 2001, when a Quebec police cruiser struck her on the Algonquin Reserve of Kitigan-Zibi.
You know, when they made that $10 million announcement for the missing and murdered, most of that money is going to the police, you know. And if you hear the stories from families, the police aren't doing anything. And a lot of these families have problems with the police and stuff like that. So I don't think this is a really good idea. And they say, oh, some of the money is for the missing and murdered. Well, it's not. It's for the police.
According to Tolley, the police won't even get the money until 2013. She's frustrated because she feels that money could be used towards other things in the meantime. Many family members also draw attention to police inaction, or even worse, complicity in these deaths. For example, last November, former Royal Canadian Mounted Police Corporal Catherine Galliford revealed that RCMP and Vancouver police officials would often watch porn on the job and leave work early to get drunk while they were supposed to be working on a missing women task force. Galliford and 25 other current and former female RCMP officers are now filing a class action lawsuit against the force due to sexual harassment and assault in the workplace. Groundwire asked Mohawk activist and former president of Quebec Native Women, Ellen Gabriel, what she hoped would come out of the UN inquiry.
Well, hopefully action. I mean, there is, I think it's what, a 23-person panel of the UN that's going to be making an inquiry into Canada's lack of action and the situation, you know, investigating what the families have been through. And so hopefully some protocols that the police will be able to use. Some more awareness among children and youth, and the roles of men and women in our communities, and for people to really understand that the root causes of violence, especially amongst in Aboriginal peoples' communities and in society at large, stems from colonialism.
The Canadian government did strike a committee to investigate the issue this year, and it issued a report to Parliament in December. However, Gabriel, along with Amnesty International, slammed this report, calling it watered down and criticizing it for ignoring and deleting any references to witness testimonials and their recommendations. In the meantime, waiting for the inquiry to begin, Native women are hoping that the UN committee will be able to work with all levels of government and police forces in order to develop new tools and policing protocols in order to put an end to the disappearances and murders. The president of NWAC expects the federal government to cooperate with the international investigation, despite its lack of action. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
Groundwire correspondents Aaron Pickett and Maria Follansby of CJLY in Nelson, BC, put together this short documentary on Occupy Nelson.
Show me what democracy looks like!
This is what democracy looks like!
Show me what democracy looks like!
This is what democracy looks like!
As we move into the much ballyhooed year of 2012, we would do well to reflect on some of the lessons learned by the struggle and play of 2011, the year of Tahrir. Freedom, and the foment of activist movements worldwide.
Unlike other moments in movements, last year saw the exceptional circumstances of protest communities spreading to and sprouting up in metropolises and rural towns alike. Nelson, British Columbia, despite being a sleepy town in the Selkirk Mountains of the interior, contributed in common resonance with the worldwide struggle that has come to be known as the Occupy movement. Nelson's occupation of the town square outside of City Hall began on October 15th, with an ebullient rally in March that saw over 1,000 people of all ages flood the streets.
Oh, Well, we're all down here rebelling against corruption on Wall Street and in the world. We cannot forget the corruption that exists in our own little sweet town of Nelson. Nelson is the fourth or fifth worst-run municipality in British Columbia, according to people who know. So, get out and vote, folks. Get politically active, because there's a lot of corruption here in town we have to deal with.
Those elders, they're in our hearts, and you are recognized. Second, I really want to thank the youth that are doing their reports and their research online and finding out what it means to occupy Wall Street. So I want to thank you, all of you, for coming out, and I want you to look around and I want you to ask, where are our leaders? Our leaders are right here. They're right beside you, and they're in your heart.
The seeds that were planted on that International Day of Action grew into a solid occupation of approximately 10 to 15 regular campers who quickly drew the ire of Nelson's municipal government in the midst of seeking re-election. After initially offering tepid support for the campers, 10 days after the municipal elections, Kevin Cormack, city manager, and Mayor John Dooley gave the campers a letter notifying that they face removal 24 hours later at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, November 30th. This notice was predicated on a 40-year-old bylaw that makes public camping, amongst other activities, punishable by a $30 fine.
The community rallied to support the occupiers as dozens showed up at 4 o'clock to defy the notice. No city officials were in attendance and the occupation continued.
It's legally speaking, it's based on the Section 16A of the Parks bylaw for the City of Nelson. And they're saying that based on the bylaw that we have to leave by Wednesday, November 30th at 4 p.m. We've done our own research and we've read the bylaw, and in actual matter of fact, the only punishment that can be given for an infraction against the bylaw is a ticket. So they cannot come, by law, they cannot come and physically remove us or remove our structures.
Officially defeated. The intentions of City Council. To have us evicted.
And we're gonna stay.
The next day, however, when the campers, many of whom are homeless and had been denied the use of cooking equipment on site, left their camp to find lunch, city officials, accompanied by a contingent of the Nelson Police Department and its chief, Wayne Holland, confiscated all the campers' equipment, including tents, sleeping bags, clothing, and the Similac belonging to the parents of a 10-month-old baby. This is what Kevin Cormack and Wayne Holland had to say at the time.
Well, it was my decision to, to move forward to have the tents and other structures removed as per the eviction order.
But from a perspective of risk management, exposure by the city to any litigation, should anybody, due to inclement weather and or the structures becoming flammable and or collapsing, should any harm befall anybody, there was thought that there could be an exposure to the city. So for the good of all, it was decided that all the structures would be removed.
Despite these actions by the City of Nelson and its police department, the Occupy movement in Nelson continues to thrive, holding regular general assemblies and enjoying broad-based support. We will continue to watch this story throughout the new year.
Our last feature in this episode is on the topic of modern slavery in Canada and the world. It was contributed by Accessible Media Inc. and is hosted by Marjorie Nicolaou.
And now, a feature from Contact, the interview program heard on Voiceprint, a service of Accessible Media Incorporated. In its December 11th edition, Contact presented a special documentary, Modern Slavery in Canada and the World. Here is an excerpt.
It's estimated that 27 million people around the world are enslaved, even in Canada. Carly Sapoznik, co-founder and president of the Alliance Against Modern Slavery, explains.
The RCMP estimates that there are 800 to 1,200 people in Canada, the vast majority of them women and girls, that are victims of human trafficking every year. However, the non-governmental organizations in Canada peg the number in the thousands, with a significant percentage of that being Aboriginal children and women.
According to the 2011 annual report on human trafficking by the U.S. State Department, Canada is, quote, a source, transit, and destination country for men, women, and children subjected to sex trafficking and forced labor. Canadian women and girls, particularly from Aboriginal communities, are found in conditions of commercial sexual exploitation across the country, end quote.
The First Nations community has been particularly vulnerable to enslavement. In Winnipeg, for example, we're seeing a lot of young girls coming down from the reserves, and we've identified a triangular trade between Winnipeg, Thunder Bay, and Kenora. Some researchers have recently compared the treatment of Aboriginal young girls in Winnipeg in particular, in their north end, to Haiti in terms of the amount of sexual exploitation. In almost all of the cases that have impacted Aboriginal communities, the form of slavery has been human trafficking for sex, prostitution. And these girls are as young as 9 years old, 10 years old. And what we see is often it's maybe a boyfriend or even a family member who traffic them, who sell them, and they are able to earn up to $300,000 a year off of these young girls. It's not like drug trafficking or illegal arms trafficking. With human beings, unfortunately, and with these Aboriginal young girls and other victims across our country, they're used over and over again.
People with disabilities are not spared such degradation.
We've seen a number of different cases affecting individuals with disabilities. There have been, in some cases, I've heard of one in New York where it was called the Deaf Mexican case. Often we think of, you know, slavery as something that's hidden. It's in the domestic arena. It's somewhere where people cannot see what is happening. But in this case, the Mexicans were in the middle of New York, and in spite of being in a public place, they were cut off by virtue of their deafness and their inability to use North American Sign Language. They were actually standing in crowds in New York but couldn't communicate. In other cases, we've seen women who have had disabilities. In one case, for example, she had Down syndrome, and the trafficker in that case exploited her, was able to lure her in a little bit more easily. In another case, there was the promise of work in China that I know of, and 33 individuals were forced to work in a factory and also in another case in a construction site. And I wouldn't necessarily say that there is a particular way in which slavery affects those with disabilities. I would say more that those with disabilities are one of the most vulnerable groups to enslavement, just as these other groups that are vulnerable.
That was an excerpt from the documentary Modern Slavery in Canada and the World that was recently broadcast on Voiceprint's interview program, Contact. To hear the documentary in its entirety, please visit their website at ami.ca and follow the Contact link on the homepage.
Was an excerpt from the song Stockholm by the Great Uncles of the Revolution from their album Stand Up.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report.
Here's Sandra Johnstone from CHLY in Nanaimo, BC, with a short update on Cortez Community Radio.
2011 was a tumultuous year for community radio stations across Canada. Toronto residents are still mourning the loss of CKLN Radio, which had its license to broadcast revoked by the CRTC, marking the end of one of Canada's oldest campus radio stations. In an effort to subsidize rising costs of broadcasting in a large commercial market, CFRO, another longtime nonprofit station in Vancouver, sold off a large chunk of its broadcasting range to the Jimmy Pattison Group. But as some of the older stations struggled, 2011 also saw the dawn of new community radio stations in Canada. One of these new stations was born on Cortez Island, a small island on Canada's west coast. Nestled at the entrance to Desolation Sound, Cortez is about 25 kilometers long and 13 kilometers wide, and is situated in traditional Clahoos First Nations territory. The population is around 950 people. A nonprofit society was formed in 2003 with the goal of establishing an FM radio station licensed by the CRTC. In 2005, these plans were disrupted when a private individual moved to the island and started broadcasting without a license. This type of illegal broadcasting is sometimes referred to as pirate radio. The society approached this individual, and eventually a public studio was set up on the island. Residents of the island could now produce their own radio show, which was broadcast at 80 watts across the island and streamed across the world online. But this didn't change the fact that the broadcast was still illegal. The station continued to broadcast this way until 2010, when the society received notice that they must apply for a CRTC license. Luckily, they were not forced to shut down broadcasting while awaiting approval from the CRTC. In late 2011, Cortez Radio received the official go-ahead to broadcast legally. Now that the station is legit, the little nonprofit has big plans, including moving to a larger studio and establishing a satellite studio on Quadra Island. Reporting for Groundwire, I'm Sandra Johnstone.
The second part of our community radio report this episode is contributed by Terry Brennan of Kootenai Cooperative Radio. Terry spoke with Zoe Creighton, co-coordinator of the Sounds Cooperative Initiative. This project is to be carried out in partnership with the National Campus and Community Radio Association and will encourage and teach campus and community radio stations across the country to become more cooperative.
I'm in here in the studio this morning with Zoe Creighton, co-coordinator of the Sounds Cooperative Project. Good morning, Zoe.
Good morning, Terry.
And can you start with telling us a little bit about the project?
Yes, indeed. We're pretty excited about it because as part of the UN-declared International Year of Co-ops, which is 2012, Kootenai Co-op Radio and the NCRA have joined forces to produce a wonderful project called the Sounds Cooperative Project with a nice chunk of funding received from the Co-op Development Initiative, Innovative Co-ops Project Program. And what we're doing is working together to encourage radio stations to become more cooperative. And the way we're doing that is kind of chunked out into a couple of different components. The first is something that's actually been, well, I know, Terry, you and I have talked about it a lot as one of the kind of newest co-op radio stations in BC. As like after we became a co-op, there were lots of people kind of asking us, how do you become a co-op radio station? Well, this project is addressing that, but on a national scale. So we're putting together an online handbook that will teach people both how to set up a cooperative and how to set up a community radio station, and ultimately how to set up a co-op community radio station, as well as give a little bit of information about the history of co-ops in Canada and do profiles on, I think there are 16 co-op radio stations across the country, a number of whom are members of the NCRA. And just to provide an online resource that can also be printable, we're going to create it as a PDF as well, for people to actually get the physical tools needed to set up a community radio station. So that's kind of the first part of the project. The second part is the production of 5 audio documentaries that are going to be available to campus and community radio stations across the country. We're also maybe going to put them in libraries. The the big educational piece. And they're going to be half-hour documentaries, each produced by one of the NCRA's member co-op stations. And we get the opportunity, we here at CGLY and Nelson get the opportunity to do the first one, which is going to be on the history of co-ops in Canada. The other content will be a documentary on co-op principles, with stations as examples, a documentary on innovative co-ops and the use of the co-op model. Also included in that will be a documentary on the IYC 2012, which is the International Year of Co-ops, and the celebrations and legacies that are being created this year across the country to mark the totally once-in-a-generation declaration by the United Nations that cooperatives build a better world, and that especially these days, there's always an opportunity to posit cooperatives as a solution to economic and social ills. But these days, it really seems like people are looking for some cogent example of what is an alternative to what can be seen as a kind of failing capitalist system. And co-ops and community media are two of those. And so these documentaries will help to do the public education around that. And the third, if I haven't talked too much already.
You haven't.
Okay. The third is we are going to be setting up five regional workshops across the country, one of which is going to be hosted here in Nelson. And there's going to be one hosted in Vancouver and in Nova Scotia and in Saskatchewan. And they're going to provide community stations with an opportunity to bring in other community media people, other community radio people, to learn both about how to make their respective stations work more cooperatively, but also to, if there are any emerging stations, how to teach them to set up as co-ops. It also provides an opportunity and basically a little bit of seed money for each of these stations to engage in kind of shared learning around the mechanics of radio stations or emerging technology or whatever. And we've had one of these regional conferences in the past, and they were very useful for the new stations and also good for us to learn by teaching and by learning from new perspectives. The final part of this project is that we're going to hire a bunch of co-op developers who are going to work across the country to actually help each emerging station with the mechanics of either incorporating as a co-op or transitioning from a society to a co-op. So with the end goal of hopefully having a handful of new co-op stations established across the country.
Great. Thanks for that outline, Zoe. Folks who are listening, if they want to get more information, what's the best way to tap into the project?
SoundsCooperative.coop is going to be launched early in the new year, and that will provide people who come onto it with, we're kind of going to do a progress of the project, uploading things as they arrive, talking about when the regional workshops are scheduled, have the agenda of the workshops on there. We're going to put the handbook there, obviously, and have the documentaries available there for download. So it's soundscooperative.coop.
Great. Thank you, Zoe. That was Zoe Creighton, co-coordinator of the Sounds Cooperative Project. And keep your eyes peeled and ears open for more to come with that.
For the January 1st edition of Groundwire, a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. This edition was produced on Seneca's traditional territory in the studios of CJLY, a cooperative community station in Nelson, BC.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Annika Roche.
And I'm Catherine Fisher. In this episode, we heard features by Accessible Media Inc., Aaron Lakoff of CKUT Montreal, and Maria Follinsby and Aaron Pickett of CJLY Nelson. Community radio reporting was contributed by Terry Brennan of CJLY Nelson and Sandra Johnstone of CHLY Nanaimo. Music was by Lull, Great Uncles of the Revolution, and Robert Minden and Carla Hollett.